Sir, I'm going to pass around the sign-in sheet, so please do sign in. Just an upcoming on November 13th, Mike Blackhurst, who's now here at UXER, will be doing interdisciplinary modeling of environmental resources insight from three recent projects. And closing out our fall term will be Andrew Arin, who's now the Vice President for Research at the National Low Income Housing Coalition in Washington, understanding and addressing the housing crisis for America's low-income households. So the schedule's there. Jen Bissell's done a tremendous amount of work, as always, in helping get our brown bag series set up and running smoothly, and has nice snacks for everybody. So please enjoy them.
Thanks for the snacks.
I want to introduce Professor Isley Healy from the Université de Jean Monnet in Lyon, France. And she's been a very, now we call you a frequent visitor to Pittsburgh, conducting research on a number of redevelopment organizations and the politics and background of some of those pieces and what's going on. And today she's going to be talking about urban renewal in Europe, is renewing deprived areas of European cities a European matter.
Thank you all for this presentation, and thank you for giving me the floor. So maybe I could start with a short, introduction. So about my background in a few words, just to let you know that I did a PhD in political science, in French political science, which is not exactly the same as what the main political science is like in America. So I think here I'm more, I'm closer to what geographers and people do in urban studies rather than political science. I mainly focused it on economic leaders and urban governance, mainly in Lyon. But I also, at that time, got involved, because I got funding for that, in a European network. And this is important because that's how I got interested in the way cities, well, get in touch with Europe, gather, try to make their way through, between, or over the states in order to work with Europe. Today, what I'm going to present you are the results of a collective research that was carried out with other people, some of whom the names I wrote down. We got original funding, it lasted for 6 years, and we focused on Eurocities, which is one very important European city network. And we did historical sociology, mainly micro, and therefore based on qualitative data. My speech is going to be in three parts, focusing on the three different governmental levels involved in some ways, at some stage, in renewing deprived urban neighbourhoods, sorry for the mistake. Although neighbourhoods is definitely, to me, and as far as I know, an American word and an American term. We use the word quartier, but it's different. It doesn't have the same implication, especially in terms of the people's involvement there. Okay, we don't have any CDCs, we don't have things like that. So I don't know if speaking about neighborhoods without CDCs would make sense. That's a question I put up to you. I don't know. Of course, please don't hesitate and stop me, especially if you don't understand my English, and ask questions, make comments all along. Okay, that's the abstract I sent you along with the flyer. It gives you the general idea.
Can you speak a bit louder for the end
of the yeah, of course, sorry. Yeah. So it gives you a general idea of what I'm going to go through. In the 1990s, European institutions got involved in urban renewal projects linked to urban deprived neighbourhoods, but only in the 1990s. Since then, they also seem to have given up their ambition to set up a proper urban last-longing community policy. Nevertheless, European programs dedicated to cities did exist at some stage and did have some impact, and do still have some impact on renewal policies in Europe. So it remains interesting to know how they started doing that, not only because we don't know what's going to happen again in the future and they might come back to that, but also because what they've done has had an impact. Main questions I'm going to tackle, so why in 1990s, in what context, what was set up, why did they stop, what remains today, what impact, knowing that the hardest question I, of course, left for the end. So three different levels. I'm going to start with the state. In America, people would probably maybe start differently, but in Europe, and especially when you're French, of course, you're going to start with the state. It has to be underlined that the state played and still plays a major role in urban renewal in France, in Great Britain, in the Netherlands, but also in Northern Europe and in Eastern Europe. So in very different historical, with very different historical backgrounds, of course. Three countries have very specific, heavily funded, cross-cutting policies that are dedicated to deprived urban areas, that is to say France, Great Britain, and the Netherlands. So they have chosen to develop a global apprehension of deprived neighborhoods, all together with social programs, economic development, and planning. These three. I'm going to just give you a bit of background related to the case of France, which is, of course, the one I know the most. After the Second World War, of course, the state had to deal with reconstruction matters. It got deeply involved, and it was the most and foremost actor leading programs in that area. The higher administration at that time was very powerful. I think it's traditional. As far as I know, you've had the same thing around here too, but there were major, massive top-down projects. For example, building motorways, high towers downtown, but also, and that is interesting for us here, in the suburbs, which you don't have here, as far as I know, at least not to the same extent. I'll show you photographs. After May 1968, some residents started to oppose these projects, to say that they were monstrous projects. So they set up associations or non-profit organizations. In the 1970s, the state and France discovered its banlieue. I suppose you know the word, especially because at that time there was a shift in population within this banlieue. At first, some people, many citizens, thought they would be very nice places where people could mix and live together, but in the 1970s, the middle classes left these places because it was getting too... The atmosphere and the context was getting too difficult for them, so they went back to downtowns. Still in the 1970s, as a reaction, what was set up was the Politique de la Ville, and I'm sorry, I kept it in French, because as far as I know, I've never found a very good translation for that. What is at stake here is a global perspective with comprehensive planning, and a lot of partnerships between the state and local authorities. So it's very specific, I'm sorry. Most people keep it in different languages, Politique de la Ville. In the 1980s, we had our first banlieue riots, especially in Les Minguettes. I put it here because I'll show you a photograph after that. And in 1990, there was a Ministry of the City set up, so at the central level. Since then, of course, many critics were addressed to that policy, and thus many changes were reforms were set up, but it remains an important policy, and with an increasing role of cities. I'll come back to that later. These are examples of what was set up and built in the 1960s. So the first picture here is the A7, so it's a motorway, coming into Marseille in the south of France. I'm sorry, most of you probably, most and foremost, know about Paris, but I'm not going to talk about Paris today. Marseille, so what is impressive here is maybe you can't really see it, but the motorway comes right into the city center of Marseille. Same thing in Lyon, with something that is maybe even more impressive. It's Perrage, so with a spaghetti junction there. And with high civil servants from that period, from the 1960s, who were very, very proud because it was a technical, very ambitious project for various reasons. But of course, this is still nowadays, these two motorways, so the south part and the part in Lyon, major problems because planners do not know what to do with that. And they don't know how to get rid of these spaghetti junctions really in the core of the city. Two other examples of these high towers built in France. And so I wanted to show you to what extent it, I mean, it's not one tower from here and there, like the one in East Liberty, which name I forgot, that was destructed a few years ago. It's not just one, it's a whole neighborhood made of towers, in this case in the south of Lyon, also Les Minguettes, where the first riots emerged, and in the middle of nowhere, if I'm a bit quick. And this is in Marseille, where riots, well, not riots nowadays, but major crime problems occur like, at the moment. It's in the northern part of Marseille, and you can see that that's the normal level of the city, and boom, you have a physical border there. Okay, so about that state intervention, central states have been playing a major role, both in constructing and then renewing deprived areas. Since the Second World War, central states have, though, to different extents and following different paths and strides, decentralized some of their programs, mainly to cities. So of course there are different situations. France is historically a Jacobin state, and Spain and Italy are far more decentralized, but still the state is involved. In the end, two questions arise in all these countries. How did cities react when they started implementing programs along with the state and by themselves, or by themselves, and was there or is there a place for a European urban policy dedicated to these areas when you know that states are so present or involved? Second type of actors, so the cities. That's another part of the picture. If I, in a few words, try to give you a historical background, although some of you might know it, In the Middle Ages, cities were very powerful in Europe. We have a tendency to forget about that. Of course, there's the case of the city-states like Genoa, Venice, but more generally, towns and cities were very important and had a very important political power, even in terms of peacemaking. So that's, for example, what Max Weber shows. In the 18th and mainly 19th centuries, then modern states emerged and centralized political power, took it off municipalities. Nevertheless, and this is another important point, cities and municipalities never stopped acting and tried to get rid of poverty. Why do I say that? Because we have a tendency to forget, because of that, of these states and very powerful states, we have a tendency to forget that cities remain places, important places in terms of innovation. For example, they played a great role in the emergence of the welfare state. Some cities were had social municipal leaders, so were really in favor of the development of public services. And especially around Paris, this time I'm going to mention it, they even started thinking of acting beyond the borders of the city. Okay. Last thing that I'm going to develop more longer, cities also develop strategies of internationalization and thus Europeanization, both for economic reasons and political reasons. So that's what I'm going to speak about now. The internationalizations and mainly Europeanizations of cities is a process to be considered over a long period. we too often think that it began in the 80s, 1980s. It began at the end of the 19th century and following three different things: study trips, twin cities, and then networks. Study trips and conferences, cities at the end of the 19th century, exchanged good practice about roads, public transports, buildings, housing, everything they could intervene on. It's a very long-lasting tradition, and that's just an anecdote, but for example, in the archives I found that people from Saint-Étienne were sent to Pittsburgh in the 1970s to study industrial depollution here and to bring new practice back home. That's when the first networks were set up, especially the International Union of Local Authorities, that despite its name was a municipal network, most of all, and with a very political aim, they were fighting for local autonomy and local public policies, okay, the development of the increase. After the Second World War, these cities and their unions denounced the incapacity of the states and their and international organizations to enable evolutions towards European unity. And in 1951, they set up the Council of European Municipalities and Regions that still exists and that plays an important role in Europe and that brings together all their national associations and etc. It's a more technical organization than the IULA, the first network I mentioned, less political, but it is a very important structure. Bilateral relations, so twinning, it started after the Second World War. They were set up mainly for peace and European reconstruction. They, although nevertheless, most and foremost focused on culture and art with youngsters and elderly people making exchanges, etc. It's an important trend, I'll show you photographs, but every city in France and in Europe is twinned with a list of cities. And these twinning operations were not only north-north, but also north-south, and progressively led to the development, the emergence of what is called decentralized cooperation with the south mainly, something that the states really tried to keep under control. And I don't have much time to develop, but in the case of France, the states always kept a close eye on what cities were doing there. Why? Because when a mayor had a team working on, water issues, for example, let's say pretend in Israel, that's not in France, it was more the mayor of New York, but whatever, it was an opportunity for that mayor to go to Israel, shake hands, and maybe intervene in what has become para-diplomacy. So it was a way for them to overtake their states. So these are photographs reminding you that it's a very important diplomatic business, these twinnings, the list you always find when you get into a city in France. So thanks, posts showing you who we are, the city is twinned with, the idea that it's for peace and the involvement in the south. The networks, they got mainly developed in the 1980s. They're very numerous and including, of course, Eurocities, which specificity is to be a big network and to be general, so not specialized in France. But in Europe, you have networks about light, about water, about food, about whatever. This one is a general network, so it gives it more strength. Again, the idea was to challenge national governments and to use a new levels of governments, the new level of government that has been emerging, that is to say the European Union. Notably, the Scottish cities used it in order to become more and more independent, and the British cities, because they, some of them at least, but a lot of them at that period, were anti-Thatcher, and they wanted to fight Thatcher while going to the European scene. It was a way for them to get heard by the European level, recognized as actors and important actors and partners, and of course to get funding and dedicated programs. So the search for money and solutions to better deal with deprived areas after the 1970s, so after major crises in Manchester, Birmingham, Liverpool, and I mean what happened in Pittsburgh is enormous, but it has deep links with what happened over in these cities. There has never been any legislation allowing cities to develop actions in European and international realms, but for 15 years, they nearly all now have departments and services dedicated to these topics. That's Eurocities and the House of Cities in Brussels, and showing you that they are often new, you as in cities, space if you want to go to Brussels and make a point, try and meet commissioners, etc., etc. So, cities used Europeanization and its different patterns mainly against their states. Since the end of the 19th century, cities have tried to gather to set up international connections in order to gain autonomy and thus ability to deal with their specific issues, including from the beginning dealing with deprived urban areas. At the end of the 20th century, of course, things have changed, but it's going their way. Globalization, economic crisis, decentralization, and Europeanization helps them become or re-become major actors. And nowadays, large cities aspire to European visibility, both for economic and political reasons. The question that remains is, in return, how did the European institutions react and what did they do? Did they give money? Did they do anything? Sorry. So for a very long time, the EU was mainly focused on economic and agricultural policies. In terms of institutions, there is no proper official representations of cities. The ECMR, the association I mentioned before, is recognized, but it's both for cities and regions. There is nothing specific for cities. So what happened? After numerous enlargements, the inequalities within Europe became striking and nearly shocking. But the European institutions, I'm putting that really briefly, but they couldn't really focus on countries only. Say the reaction of Thatcher, I want my money back. So if you focused on the national level, you would face reactions from France, Great Britain, saying no, you can't focus on Italy, on Spain, that doesn't work. So they put it differently and they decided to act on regions rather than at the state level. In 1988, they set up the DG Regio, so the Directorate General within the Commission dedicated to regions, and that department set up policies based on partnerships between the different levels of government and with private actors. And the ERDF, so the European Regional Development Fund, funded in 1975, sorry, I skipped that, found its budget doubled. Then there was subsidiarity with the Treaty of Maastricht. It's a bit technical, sorry, so I'll go fast. Then again, the ERDF got its budget doubled, and in 1994, the Committee of the Regions was set up. It's only a consultative body, but at least local authorities have a proper representation in Brussels and in European institutions. So in the end, it's only in the 1990s that emerged a proper community urban policy. Eurocities played a great role in that, but also, of course, political figures like Bruce Millin, who was responsible for the DG Regio, and Jacques Delors, I'm not saying that because I'm French, but this happened to be the case, who was the then president of the Commission. In 1991, they set up a program dedicated not only anymore to regions, but to regions and cities. And then, in 1994, the first urban program, so the first European policy dedicated to urban deprived areas, 1994 only. Now, that's not the end of the story. At the end of the 1990s, some states reacted, especially France, Great Britain, England mainly, and the Netherlands. So those who had some politique de la ville or things very close, and they put pressure on the Commission. They didn't want that European policy to go on. It nearly was abandoned, but they still managed to keep Urban 2 on tracks in 2000, although with a smaller budget, and with each state intervening and choosing which programs and thus which cities would get the money and the help from the European Union. In 2006, it was the end of Urban, and they created a new type of European urban policy, URBACT, but it's only about exchange of good practice, so there are no concrete projects involved. And in 2016, well, it's too early to say, but they are working at the European Urban Agenda. But to me, it's too early to say, but to me, it's really only focused on wide common principles rather, again, than on concrete projects. So what did they do? What was Urban about? I'll skip the Parkinson report, but Parkinson worked with Eurocities, and he's an English academic, and he worked on France, Great Britain, and Holland to help them define what cities could do. Urban was, as often with European policies, mainly about how cities should work in order to get money. And what they did is that they put great emphasis on public-private partnerships. So some academics work on, you know, trying to, well, some academics underline that to them it's a neoliberal perspective. They also, sorry, I skipped this type of partnership, but it's very important. They put a great emphasis on partnerships between public authorities, and in some countries, like in Spain, it was a revolution because local authorities were not used to work together. And they had to if they wanted to get the money. They put a great emphasis on cross-cutting perspectives, so social, economic, planning, etc. Now, what about after Urban? Well, it's not the end of the city's actions towards Europe. City associations and networks remain very active up to today, and they do still obtain programs from different DGs this time, not only the DG Regio, but also programs on environment, economics, etc. That means they have to work with a lot more people within the Commission and the Parliament. And all this despite the major cuts in European budgets. The last thing I'd like to underline is that the project Urban itself evolved, and even more urban and then urbact, and thus what the cities tried to implement evolved from the 80s, where the aim was really to deal with deindustrialization, especially in England, to nowadays, where, especially within Eurocities, for example, it's more a network of winners and cities that are doing well, smart cities, working on sustainable urban development, etc., etc. So it's never been the losers, because they were second cities, not tiny cities, but they're definitely now presenting themselves as winners. I don't think I have time, but I didn't find great photographs, so I just included a link to Urban's website, where there are lots of information on the different projects they realized. So as a conclusion, I'd like to underline the fact that there is no proper and there has never been any proper long-lasting community policy dedicated to cities in Europe, not even mentioning to urban deprived areas. But the EU is definitely a new structure of opportunities, providing a wide range of resources, not only for the state, but also for cities. And it is impacting the ways cities implement their public policies. And the EU has become a major partner of local government authorities, not only in building wide, large new roads, well, not as large as here, but large in European standards, or this type of infrastructures like airports and so on, but also in initiating local development or redevelopment programs and in launching transborder cooperation programs. This is what I wanted to present you today. Now, if you have questions, you're welcome to ask them, and if not, I'll suggest you questions because there are plenty of things I didn't go through.
If you want to, you can also go back to the pictures. I think, you know, that's, if you want to put them up, that's fine. Go ahead, Ralph.
So I read very recently that in 16 EU countries that there's an association called Social and Economic Councils of government, business, union representatives who get together and study issues and make recommendations to the national governments. Is there such a structure at a city level in major cities where you have non-governmental association, including government, business, unions?
That's a very good question. Sorry, there's something I skipped. Especially these networks nowadays, they gather political leaders and, would you say, technicians? Well, professionals from the cities, from the municipalities. Okay? Now, EuroCities has started integrating private companies and corporations. But as far as I know, they're not very interested in the non-profit sector. And to more broadly answer your question, no, not as far as I know, especially because, well, I'll speak only for France, but getting corporations and unions together at the same table, not mentioning local political leaders, is not that easy, even within one city. Now, having said that, you have other, you have networks that specialize in helping cities meet corporations, but they're clients. It's different, I think, to what you were saying.
Yeah. It's also different in Eastern Central Europe, where I do a lot of my work, where it's amazing how I look at this picture of Marseille and Lyon, and this just reminds me of the socialist housing that went up in the 60s and 70s and 80s. So the real estate drives a lot of social and urban redevelopment issues because they built it quickly, they built it cheaply, there was no architectural design, there was no use, the units weren't insulated. Especially in Central Eastern Europe, you had a building that was four stories or less, you had no elevators. So a lot of the urban renewal issues that are in my part of the world look very similar to that, where they build them, they warehouse people, they don't take care of them. It's sort of a real estate issue driving the social. But also in Central Eastern Europe, because of their history as the power coming from the top down, it's very rare that you have bottom-up cooperating. You see a lot more public-private partnerships. Poland, for example, gets a lot of European Union money, and that's where they do a lot of their infrastructure, highway, rails. It's starting to trickle down, but you've got a similar municipal setup to Pittsburgh in that you have village, borough, township, city, county. Brian, you sort of have that Domina, Miasto, Biesch. So it's still not a lot of talking, as she mentions, in between the two. It'll come from the top down, not necessarily from the bottom up, and you've got foreign actors coming in that are funneling money through public-private partnerships to rebuild urban areas. But they're doing sprawl things like they do in Western Europe, where they're building huge office parks, 1,000-unit apartment properties, on these little vacant pieces of land. So they're not necessarily focusing on the urban core. They're still doing the suburban sprawl in a lot of respects.
Just one thing, maybe. I'm not a specialist of Eastern Europe at all, but I think that if we were to put photographs beside one another, for example, in Bratislava,
that's like socialist housing.
Yeah, but I think in Bratislava, if you were to take a picture, it would be twice as big.
Oh yeah.
So that's
huge.
That's
they
one difference.
Anything
still.
Here.
And the second thing that I'm really treading on eggs. I think that maybe one thing, at least definitely in France, if not in a lot of European countries, set aside maybe Great Britain, the state is so important and the public sector is so important that there, as you mentioned, very little grassroots movements. And when Europe says, okay, you have to go for public-private partnership, it means that citizens are left between public service and the private actors, but they have no proper means to, you know, gather, keep an eye on what's going on, say what they want. And now I'm really making that really broad. But that's my feeling, especially after spending a few weeks in Pittsburgh and trying to figure out what the differences are to better understand what's happening here. Yeah.
How are the Banyos sites, how are they selected? Are these near to factories or workplaces?
Within urban?
In Lyon and Marseille.
Ah, in the 60s? Gosh, that's a good question. They were selected in high towers in Paris among high civil by high civil servants, of course, based on economic population data. But about the sites, no, I can't say. I really.
What's the socioeconomic status of the people that live in these two complexes?
Today or in the 1960s?
I'd be interested in both. That would be interesting.
There's been that's what I said about the 1970s. So there's been a major shift. And that's maybe one difference with the Eastern case too. Really, in France, in the 60s, most of the people believed in planification, in the central role of states. They truly believed in it, and they thought it was the best way to defend general interest, and not only these high civil servants, it was very spread out throughout the population. So when they started building some of these places, a lot of people moved there, and it was pretty mixed. But then, of course, you had waves of migration, per se. So people different coming and also wanting to live in these places, and because rents, the level of the rents were not very expensive, they started settling down there. It made it implied a loss of value, That's when, of course, there was the economic crisis, second loss of value, progressive, and there was an architectural mistake that high civil servants, most of them admitted that, made about these areas, because they were meant to be lively, mixed areas, neighborhoods, and with nice parks, with little shopping areas where people would move easily, but they got it completely wrong, and that's not what happened at all. And those little squares and playgrounds are very, not in 5 years, but throughout the decades, turned out being places for drug dealing and things like that, and not at all being neighborhood friendly. So all that added together ended up in the 1970s for higher income households to just leave these places. And after at the end of the 1970s, there are really poor areas. I mean, it's a caricature. And of course, with in some places, more than 90% of them with ethnic minority roots. And
with the guest workers are Algerian, the Pied Noir.
Bantustans.
Yeah. So, among whom most of them are French, but that's the whole thing about the riots that took place a few years ago now. A lot of observers, critics say that these people were parked outside the cities. And for example, in Lyon, if you look simply at buses and the metro, it took ages before they accepted to build the metro line that would go that far. In most cities, the metro stations stopped just before to make sure they wouldn't come into downtown so much, knowing that, you know, European cities are the opposite to American cities. Everything happens in downtown, not in the suburbs.
Typically, these were not these. Most of these developments, just in general, did not replace existing neighborhoods and housing. I mean, pattern
it was
here.
It was added.
There was land available, so that's where it went. Mm. Unlike Pittsburgh, where huge neighborhoods were raised in order to do the same thing. So that obviously has lots of implications. You know, you don't have anybody fighting for the land. There was nobody there first.
No, old Paris is an interesting case because in that perspective, because because there is so much pressure there, so many people wanting to leave close to Paris, that it maintains a certain level of pressure on these lands, not in most other French cities, for example. Same thing in London.
And I'm pretty sure those buildings have not been maintained, have not been updated, don't have good property management in them. You go warehouse the poor people there and forget about it. I can tell. It's probably what
It depends. These two cases are a bit different. Now, again, I'm not a specialist, but as far as I know, Les Minguettes in Lyon has changed a lot. Now, the problem wasn't solved, it was just moved a bit further.
There was a big French housing project that was in the news a couple of years ago.
Uh-huh.
You know, 10 stories where I call it the tenants had taken over the building. They were throwing chairs off the building, they were showing the building where the ceiling's falling down, the pipes are falling down. My first thought was that is a real estate issue, which creates a social issue. But that was the thing. You build these things in the 70s with money, you run out of money, you've got people that don't know how to maintain them or fix them or update them. You have people moving in that may not know what to do when they get in there. Yes, you should probably keep your apartment clean. Or you don't have someone that's managing that building that can actually know what the asset is, do tenant screening, make sure you're getting people in there that need social services. If you've got the guest workers, well, make sure they have some programs so they can assimilate the community. A lot of these issues are universal.
Yeah, no, just two things. There's one thing I forgot to mention that is dramatically important. In the 1970s, there was Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, whatever, the president of France was right-wing, and he had a very important policy trying to make people become homeowners.
Like here.
Yeah, that nothing. But I forgot to mention it. It's important because they set up tools to, and these tools make people flee from these areas, and get their own home in other places. Okay.
So these were all rental units, originally.
Most, not at the start. I wouldn't know the percentage, but a good part of it was rental. And over the years, it became more and more rental because the state institutions rebuilt some of these buildings and kept them as social housing. It's nearly all social housing now. Now, they have done things. They have destructed lots of towers, first thing.
They've what?
they distracted them.
So
they got rid of them.
They're taking some down, Bloom.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Numerous. Although it's very expensive, but
right.
they have done it. They have tried to change the all the tools they have that allow low-income families or individuals to get access to public housing. They have tried to make some of them go to other areas, including downtowns, in small numbers. So they have done lots of things. Now, having said that, in Lyon, not in Les Minguettes, but in Vaux-en-Velin, so it's about 3 kilometers further, you now have problems. So they dealt with Les Minguettes, but it's the problems grew just beside, and in Marseille and in this area is really deprived still today. I mean.
So, and we don't have Dave Weber here, but sometimes we have somebody mm-hmm. from the Housing Authority of the City of Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. So, in the United States, it got devolved down to city housing authorities.
Mm-hmm.
And they would be the manager of the building or the non-manager in the case that you're talking about. And in fact, some housing authorities, like the Chicago Housing Authority, was taken out of business at one point because they couldn't maintain anything. and a lot of those are gone. Robert Taylor homes are gone. I mean, the Cabrini Green is gone.
A lot of housing authorities.
No, yeah, I mean, a lot of the kind of housing that the Chicago Housing Authority couldn't maintain, mm-hmm. and the Robert Taylor homes is the closest we'd have been anywhere in the United States to anything like this, but it was all lined up like very linear, very, very linear. But they're all gone. They were taken, they're taken, not all of them, but many of them, they're gone. And remade in what became in the 1990s, remaking public housing as we know it under Bill Clinton and what became the Hope 6 program, which was mixed income and to some extent mixed use housing with services there and so forth. So if we were looking at a picture of this today, you said a lot of it would be gone or just some of it?
Well, if you could take these two cases, no.
Okay, so it's mostly all, it's all social housing
yeah.
and it's maintained by local housing authorities or some
No.
I mean, it's got to be national. In
most social. I can't translate that word.
Yeah.
Sorry. But these specific, it's part of the state. I mean.
No, yeah. Yeah, we're a federal system, so it gets devolved down. The money starts at the federal level, and then it came through. Then it goes into the local. So here, it's all by a national housing authority.
Yeah. These. Now, of course, they have used tools in order to try and make corporations and private actors get involved, maybe not in these two areas, but in the borders of the suburbs or the borders of deprived areas and make them put a foot into that. But how can I put it without what researchers have been showing about that is that I think, again, because there are no grassroots, long-lasting resident movements in France and structures, these private actors have become very good in using the tools set up in order, for example, I don't have any photographs, sorry, but they have used all these tax credits things and, to build smaller buildings, maybe only 1 or 2 or 5 or 6, but in nearly every town in France, knowing that towns in France are very small, and they sold them, so that's private ownership mostly, not rental, and individuals have, many individuals have lost a lot of money because these buildings were just in, situated in locations where there was no way nobody would want to go there. There was no need for any buildings of any type, even smaller. right? So what they did is that, for example, they had to have five apartments that would be public housing, and then the rest could be just plain private ownership. They found people to go in there. They got a lot of money from the state to do that, because there was 5 units of public housing, and then the individuals lost their money because the value of these buildings went down, 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 down. So again, yeah, when you're in a situation where you have a very... I'm not careful because, I mean, you can't sum up what the state has been doing in terms of deprived areas to this. I mean, the state is central for the worst and for the best. But when you have that major actor pressure to make private actors get more involved, and pressure to find new inventing tools to make them make at least a little money, even if the market isn't very good in these places, and no residents, no associations, it's tricky.
So what are the cities doing now with the migration crisis in Europe? What's their role in relation to the national government?
Cities or states?
What are the cities doing?
Cities.
Yeah.
It's a good question. I'd like to work on that a bit more. Now, first thing I would personally say is that the media are speaking a lot about this wave of migration. Now, in Germany, it's big. Well, the figures are important. In northern Europe countries, there are two. Now, if you look at France, for example, it's not such a big deal. It's not enormous. Second thing is, we are not 100% sure that even though they make promises, this is not going to weaken other trends and paths of migration, for example, from some African countries, which could make figures even easier to deal with, because in the whole it might not be that huge. And third, I know that mayors want to intervene. They try to, but if, for example, what I've started to do, if you compare with Canada, it's ridiculous what they can do, what they manage to do. For the moment, states hold things, and well, national security matters. Every good reason they can find is good to stop cities from wanting to implement programs in that field. So they are not very productive at that stage. Although they're the ones who deal with well, finding places for these people and jobs. Yeah.
So you mentioned that there are some grassroots efforts that are happening. So I know, like in Pittsburgh, we have neighborhoods that have like strong identities.
Mm-hmm.
Are the grassroots movements sort of similar in that aspect? They have strong identities and they are kind of anchored to the geographic location.
Okay. You have to be cautious with what I'm going to say, okay? It's really my point of view, and nearly more as a citizen than as an academic on that. But still, what I would say is that there are different types of mobilizations or gatherings. Firstly, nearly all started in the 1970s, as I mentioned. Some really, really strongly located, but at a very, very small level or scale. Apart from that, and for example, with people, you know, when I said some people started saying these buildings are monstrous, you had very good examples, for example, in Lille, in the northern part of France, and in Roubaix, where people well, gathered and for a long time and fought until they could get buildings to be destroyed and replaced by something else. But apart from that, I would say that the logic is a lot less located, related to a territory. So a lot less than here, at least. I mean, that's how it occurs to me. And of course, you have les quartiers, but again, it's so obvious that the people who are in these quartiers and who struggle do not struggle because they come from here, but struggle because they are second or third generation of immigrants, because they have no job, because they have no diplomas. In France, if you don't have a diploma, you can't do anything. I think the mobilizations that exist are more related to a topic than to a territory. So, for example, I was a bit caricatural when I said that there was nothing going on. There are things, and there's been something in terms of access, right to be housed. Would you say that here? So you have the right to be educated, the right to etc. And they invented that new idea of right to have a home. And so there was a law passed, and now, in theory, in France, you're meant to have the right to have a house. And if you don't, so that means if you stay on lists to get access to public housing for too long, you can attack the state. It doesn't work very well. And people are being a bit discouraged to attack the state. But still, that's the picture. And for example, on this topic, there has been major mobilization. But it's not linked to one neighborhood. It's get us job, get us houses, get us... It's more this way.
So it's kind of nationwide?
It doesn't mean that the whole country and all cities and the whole population will get into these fights or mobilizations or ways of addressing local authorities or national authorities, but they will have a national perspective more than a local one. And you do have, okay, I have to make one nuance. You do have lots of local mobilizations, but mainly linked to structural projects, like you know, the for example the speed lane you have for buses here that cuts
the
into the city. Yeah,
yeah.
Busway.
Bus
each time I go on this, and I'm French, I think, oh my gosh, how many complaints they must have had. In terms of not here, it should go a little further, it should go not close to our neighborhood, and etc. It's the NIMBY. Idea around this, of course, exists a lot in France, but it's rarely a long-lasting phenomenon. When this specific project is over, these groups disappear, unlike your neighborhoods.
So you have this sort of process of many of these cities sort of turning these areas into sort of mini Bantustans, right? With a small B, those were the places in South Africa where Africans were quartered.
Yeah.
Right? Where sort of the villages where essentially they were controlled, right, under the South African government.
Like ghettos or?
Yeah, sort of like ghettos, but also very much, very much the it was a way to it was a way to sort of distinguish the rights of people who lived in one area from the rights of people who lived in from the whites who lived in another area. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But what's kind of what seems to be obvious is that, because I see this a lot in European labor,
mm-hmm.
is that. While we see American labor fight some developments in this country, some policies or developments, we do not see European labor fighting the same things, like individual plant closings, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of the U.S., if a plant closes,
mm-hmm.
it means pretty much
the continuation of deindustrialization and globalization means that those people who are laid off essentially are going to probably lose a middle class. Many of them are going to lose a middle class lifestyle. Mm-hmm. It seems like in Europe there is with some of the kinds of social
protections,
yeah. There is at least this theory that, well, you know, we can lose plants here, plants there. We shouldn't fight each of those plants because there'll be social protections and people will have some kind of social safety net, right?
Okay, so from a European point of view, I think I understand the point you're making, and I agree with it to a certain extent, but I think what I would underline is, first of all, that the position of unions has changed a lot over time,
right.
And in the 1960s, during the war with Algeria, for example, they were very political,
okay.
Even students' unions. They were dramatically, violently criticized about that, and that's in France,
mm-hmm.
Completely different in Germany. Okay, that's one of the reasons why people say unions never got introduced to managing companies in France. They were always kept outside because they were too political, too left-wing,
right.
Too revolutionary, too etc. Whereas in Germany, they were invited at the table and they take part in lots of discussions.
Right, that's correct. Right.
And then unions lost, of course, I suppose like in America, but a lot of their members, so
right.
They started weakening. As far as I'm concerned, I would say that they have become a lot less political, so I agree with you. More recently, indeed, although it has to be said that there has been major fights with Total in the east northern part of France, where they close, they still close steel mills,
right,
there are still some there, and they fight.
Okay.
So you can't say there's nothing happening.
Okay.
And the French state complains a lot about it. Although what I find interesting in your remark is the fact that France is always seen as the country where strikes go on all the time and so
right.
on. But when you look at figures,
right, because
we are
it's
really bad now.
The total unionization.
Well, really bad. We are not first on the list.
The total unionization is only 7% or something like that.
Yeah, 8%.
8%. But there are a lot more protections for working people in general.
Yeah, so
right?
I didn't
yeah.
answer that
so,
part.
So I guess the what I was trying to draw was the observation that there doesn't seem to be as much political opposition to these bad conditions in Europe, because there's this still a perception that the social democracy will take care of everything, right? The federal government will sort of take care of everything, and so therefore...
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean,
right?
Maybe indeed people are more used to knocking at the door of local authorities and trying to get their representatives change the way things are regulated than to... I mean, it brings us back to Tocqueville. Difference. Well, the American democracy and the way associations and are important here in Europe less and definitely in France. That's true. So I think it's interesting. I don't know to what extent I can agree with you with bringing data into the conversation.
Understood.
I have one more housing question. In the United States, we stopped building public housing in the 70s and 80s, and like I said, we took the HOPE 6 program to build some mixed tenure, mixed income, and mixed condition, some of it being public housing. We abandoned the Corbusian, modern design. That was one of the critiques of what American public housing was built as high rise and warehousing the poor. Have the French built public housing anymore, and if so,
yeah,
what
but not anymore like this. That's yeah. really the 1960s. Like,
yes, with design.
If you only remember that when you come out of this room, it's a bit as if you thought there's still a Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union. I mean, that's the 1960s. Now what they're doing is trying to deal with what they built, because they can't destroy everything. And, of course, they have set up what is, I think, really close to the HopeSex program with...
I know in Germany, that's what, new public housing in Germany is built, it, you know, it could be high-rise, but it's definitely not the modern, it's more of the area and the kind of traditional architecture.
They even often buy old buildings, which they renovate,
yes.
and in which they put... high level income families, medium level income families, and low level income families. So the problem is that these buildings are so attractive that they tend to, their pressure is so important that low level income families tend to either get thrown out because only wealthy people fight to, you know, arrange thing, and or middle-income families find ways in the procedures to have access to lower income, well, to apartments normally reserved for low-income families. First thing, they're better educated, they know people, they know how to go through the procedures better, and they can wait when other families can't wait, etc. And the second thing, they and that brings us back to this idea of a right for a house or a home. They also have started to understand, thanks to the political levier, etc., that it's not only a question of level of rents, it's also a question of how these people are going to get integrated within the neighborhood. And when you put, for example, in Le 16e in Paris, which is a very, very posh arrondissement in Paris, when you try to make families, poor families, settle down in this area, a great number of them flee. They don't stay.
Yeah, they. Well, and then in Dublin, the housing, they'll have like multi-level, and but the access is different. If you're in the public housing level, you don't have access to the rest of the building.
Really?
Yeah. That happens in a lot of places.
Interesting.
One more question? Go ahead.
Also, the right to adequate housing is part of the UN Charter, and a lot of people don't know that. I didn't know that until about a year ago. So there's the right to adequate housing that many countries have signed to the UN, but we know there's theory and reality as far as that goes. The Polish Constitution has housing as a right. It's in the Constitution. But in general, the right to adequate housing is a human right. But that doesn't mean it's right.
How much are people anchored to like where they live? Like, is there a conversation about keeping low-income families able to live in the neighborhoods that they've lived in versus, like, is there a conversation to try to keep them there, keep the people who are living there, and provide housing that's appropriate for them? Or is it just the process of gentrification is just happening and nobody's really trying to address that?
My answer would be that, of course, we have many places in which gentrification is occurring. Again, I would say that compared to here, in France, this matter is mainly left into public authorities' hands. So either they do something in order to stop gentrification. Well, maybe Gaspar has, but I've never ever heard of an association or a group who would stand up and say, we're against gentrification, we're going to... Never ever. I don't know, maybe somewhere, but I doubt it. So... I would say that mostly people wait and see.
Okay. Well... Professor Healy, I want to thank you and thank everybody for coming.